Hello and welcome to For the Love of Truth. This is episode 234 and is another in the Back to Hell series. And my guests today are Tony and Alex. The subject of today's discussion is the effect of a low-carb and high-fat diet on diabetes, in particular type 1 diabetes. There's a lot of really good information in this episode where we're talking about the effect that carbohydrates and sugars have on the body, and how easy it is and how effectively your body runs on alternative energy sources such as fats and proteins. So if you're interested in your health and you want to look at ways of really improving your energy and reducing the stress on your system, then there's all sorts of really good information in this episode. You guys are absolutely amazing, and I'm looking forward to talking to you in the next video. Gentlemen, good morning. Thank you so much for joining me, or us, I suppose it's us, yeah.
Good, great to be here.
Yeah, and twice in 1 week, Alex. I hope your wife understands.
Yeah, she's all right.
Cool.
She's happy at work.
I thought today would be a good opportunity to get you guys together to have a chat about diabetes and a low-carb, high-fat diet.
Definitely.
Yeah, it's my first threesome, though, so go easy on me, Alex.
Little bit. Kids won't be able to watch. Kids won't be able to watch the show. It's interesting. I think it's, you know, from my perspective, I've tried a range of different routines with regards to food. So it'd be interesting to, you know, I watched your podcast, Tony, when you spoke with Adrian, and I thought it was brilliant, really. There's an element of, you know, the information that you're giving, fantastic, how you sort of like, you know, turned it around and got yourself into, I would say, much fitter position, you know what I mean, much healthier position. And it always seems strange to me that you're in this position where you're more healthy than you've ever been, but you probably couldn't be able to do the job that you did.
I'm certainly more healthy than I ever was, I think. Bit like Adrian's experience, he's been in that state for a lot longer than I have. But I think that the last 6 years, to not have to endure any illness, really, I've not had a headache or common cold or any illness really for the last 6 years, and that period of good health can't be coincidence or just randomness. There's something I've done, I've changed, that has really improved my level of health and my ability to fight disease, if you like. And I think this is a common, as you said in one of your discussions, there's this common thread where we're sort of finding ways of making ourselves healthy that tend to go against the general advice that most people are getting from the mainstream.
Definitely.
More I talk to people like yourself and other people who've gone through this journey, whilst all the journeys are not necessarily the same in terms of what they do in terms of diet and however they change their lifestyle, it tends to go contrary to the sort of common perceptions of how to be healthy.
100%. Yeah, I totally agree. I'm just going to shut this door a second.
That's good, isn't it? The first guy I talk to and he leaves me.
And thank you, Tony.
You guys.
I totally agree, and that is the common thing that I see is everything that when I spoke to Adrian on Monday, I had a couple of eye infections that come up. I had all blotches that come up on my leg as well, and these was at different times. You know, through the diabetes, you know, being diagnosed with diabetes. And realistically, I didn't actually do anything. I didn't know it was diabetes from at least it started in September, where I wanted to sort of like a kid going a wee when we was on holiday. And I didn't actually go to the hospital until March. It was March the 1st. And so, in between that time, I obviously had symptoms and I was still sort of like battling away with it. And no doubt my blood sugars would have been, you know, when they tested it, they was at 32. So the range would have quite easily probably taken me into the 40s, you know. My own understanding, you know, from my own experiences, show me that unless you eat the right things, your blood sugars won't go down. But they'll quite easily go up, you know, and then they'll sort of like average out at a higher rate. And if you progressively put the wrong things into your body, they'll average out at a higher rate again. And that's when I think people push up to, you know, these sort of levels. And exactly right, you know, when these things happened to me, I didn't go to the doctor. I researched it myself. I asked questions. I went and see, you know, other alternative professionals and found out other bits of information, you know, that helped me along the way and took herbal remedies instead of something that potentially might be a bit evasive to what I was trying to achieve.
Yeah, it was to hear your story.
Whoa, that's a lot of feedback.
And what feedback? Where's that coming from?
I don't know. It's gone now.
Okay, good. Yeah, I think generically, over a period of many, many years, and in many areas of the way that we live, we are brainwashed by the system to believe that there's only one way of looking at problems. It doesn't matter if you talk about diabetes or health in general or viruses or physics. All of these areas, people are taught from the day they're born that this is how it is. So this is how physics is. So things like the ether, there's lots of theory about the ether and how, you know, lots of physical things can be explained in a different way. And but people like Boscovich and Tesla, etc., in that domain are sidelined by this mainstream propaganda, basically, and that discourages people from going away and considering other alternatives, because most of these things are theories, just like we've got at the moment with the viruses. There are other theories about viruses, about what they are, what their function is, and how we deal with them as human beings. The brain theory being a typical example that contradicts or gives an alternative view to germ theory. And yet, when we teach our doctors in that domain, they are taught that this germ theory is the truth, and you will adhere to that truth. Whatever evidence comes your way, you'll just push that aside, and this is how it is. And if you don't conform, we'll punish you, or you won't be able to earn a living. And
that's right.
This is what drives the sort of inability of people to believe that there are other ways of dealing with things. And Alex is a fantastic example of where the mainstream will say, this is type 1 diabetes, this is what causes it, this is the solution, and there's no other way of looking at it. But Alex has proven here that you can actually go away, independently research, take other views, homeopathic views, natural medicines, just different views that may be nearer to the truth, but that have been brainwashed out of the mainstream so that they'll never even consider it. So it's very refreshing to see people like Alex coming forward and explaining the way that they found health.
Again, you know, I have to agree. Obviously, I got an element of help, you know, initially, but I also had a bit of research behind me as well. And it was just sort of like that, where you're able. There's certain things that have happened in my life where I've had to sort of like take control and find out what needed to be done. You know, even with regards to blood clots, as I said before, when you first look at blood clots, it's devastating information. You know, you're not going to get your lungs back. You feel as, you know, if you read all of that information and you take it on mentally, it sort of like can potentially have a play. But where I was sort of like so determined to try and make my lungs recover, get myself back to full fitness, and I also had family, you know, my boy had been born, so I needed to get back to full fitness. So that's what really drove me on, you know, in that regard. But yeah, to me, you know, my the doctor I see at the hospital, I think that she's got a bit of an understanding of what I've tried to do And it's just like the GAD antibody type scenario. I sort of like nullified what had gone on then. She sort of like said, you know, 3 to 5 years, and all of a sudden, you know, 6 to 10 weeks later, the GAD antibody had reduced itself. And, you know, I've never really had a blood test since. You know, they wanted to go into the hospital to have blood tests, but I won't be wearing a mask to go in there. You know what I mean? It's sort of like pretty simple. If I need a blood test, I'll go and get one. You know, there's plenty out there where you can actually check the levels yourself to see where you're at. But my doctor, or the hospital doctor, I think she's got a bit of an understanding. And it brings us on to the conversation we were going to have today with regards to food, is because one of the things that she mentioned was that over the course of time, you know, her understanding is I would need insulin. Okay. And she said, you know, in her experience, you can only do the food side of things for a 2 or 3 year period, and then all of a sudden the body takes over and you'd end up having insulin. Okay. So there's a couple of things there. Firstly, my understanding of insulin is that it will reduce blood sugars, but we don't actually do anything about why the body itself would have raised blood sugars. So through what I've done and what I've seen for being type 1, the food element has a huge impact with regards to blood sugars. And when I went into the nutritionist, she said this, and you can eat this, and you can try this. And I said, well, I won't be having that, and I won't be having that. And I come out there and I thought, well, I don't really need her. I'm going to just crack on and keep researching, keep looking. And so the food element, I think, is quite crucial to actually try and control or have better control of the blood sugars moving forward, you know, moving up. And if you can get it to, so going back to what the doctor said, you can only go for a couple of years. It, you know, I'm at a couple of years later, and my blood sugars I've always maintained them. I kept books for a long period of time. When I went back to the doctor, she said you can still do your blood sugars like once a week. But I still sort of like maintain my blood sugars as long as they sort of like kept. I used to keep them in the range of sort of like in between 5 and 8, 5 and 9, okay. Predominantly, if I went out and exercised, if I did, you know, running, weight training, if I did, you know, circuits, cycling, those type of, you know, cardio with a bit more sort of like if you're on a bike with heels, or if you're doing cardio with weights, I would tend to find that my blood sugars would come down. And then I would start, obviously, my 15-16 hour intermittent fast would sort of like cut in after I'd done my training. I always trained in the morning, so then by sort of like 11, 12 o'clock, I'm looking to have something to eat. I'd start off with food, and then I could see that my blood sugars would go up to maybe sort of like 8, 9, that type of range, and then I could average it out. I could get myself, you know, but or it might sort of like just only be they go up to sort of like 7 or 8 over the course of time. I've maintained that sort of level, and I've obviously then when the blood sugars have gone up, so the eye infection, blood sugars are going to go up. They did do both eye infections. Legs coming up, blood sugars would go up. And that range could take you up to 14, 15, 16, 17, you know. Under normal circumstances, if you look at the information from the hospital, they'll turn around and say that at 15, blood sugars going up to that sort of level, this was the paid information. When I went to see the doctor in London, he said this. He said, obviously, once you get to 14 and 15, there's different elements that come into play within your body, ketones, and that can that can be seen within your urine. So if you had a darker urine, if you give a urine sample, that could be elements of that. That's how they check it. That's what they're looking for at the hospital. But obviously, don't take into consideration that your body could be getting rid of something that you've got that you need to let go of. It needs to come out. So it's got to come out somewhere. So with that in mind, you have this fluctuation of blood sugars. Going back to what she originally said, that over a sort of like in between a 2 or 3 year period from a food perspective, most people who in a limited experience, because it's obviously not something that she's seen done on a regular basis, that ultimately people can't sustain eating food that's going to give them less blood sugars, okay? Which is difficult, you know. You have to change your diet. You have to research. You have to know what you're putting in. You're going to move away from sugars, salts, et cetera, et cetera. And so it got to the point just after Christmas. I think it would have been sort of like end of January, I started to notice that my blood sugars are going up. So not a huge spike, you know what I mean, where they've gone up, but it was just a gradual, they're moving up a little bit. That's a bit weird. They're moving up a little bit, moving up a little bit, moving up a little bit. And so it got to the point where it was sort of like 15, 16. I'm not eating anything, still exercising, still feel fit. No symptoms of anything. So I noticed that my blood sugars had gone up. And then they sort of like went quite high. So now I sort of like started to research different things. You know, if there's anything else I can put in my body, I found a couple of different supplements that I could put in. And I got my blood sugars down to around about that sort of like 14, 15 mark again, okay? And then obviously I would work on the sports element side of it, the exercise element, to reduce them. And then what has happened is obviously speaking to Adrian, watching a couple of the other podcasts, and Adrian's mentioned about a longer fasting period. I was able to, I've worked, literally as they gently went up, I've gently moved them back down. So all of a sudden I was around sort of like the 9 or 10 mark at the lowest, and then it would go up to sort of like 13, you know what I mean? That was the range. So, and I'm moving the range down again. So for the last couple of days, I've done a longer intermittent fast and then just had what I would normally eat, or maybe a bit less than, not less volume wise. I would go for cucumbers, celeries, carrots, peppers, all colours, peppers, hummus, and that would be like a main meal. I might add nuts with that as well. And so I would have that. And then because I had that, instead of having an evening meal, I would go the longer period, obviously drinking, say, herbal teas, water, et cetera, et cetera. I then watched my blood sugars come down. So for the last 2 days, my blood sugars have been 6.8 and 7 when I've tested them. Okay. And obviously if I eat, that would sort of like be pretty normal, where I'd get a little bit of fluctuation. So I'd get it going up to 9, touching 10. And that would be where I'm at the moment. But obviously that's from a longer fasting period. And again, that would be quite, I think Adrian, you might be able to comment on that. you probably built up to doing a longer fasting period. It's not something that you could just go and do immediately.
No, you're absolutely right. I think it's if you tried to step into any kind of fasting period and you were eating carbohydrates and stuff as your main energy source, you'd have a terrible time. Because I eat more fats and proteins and not much carbs, I do have some, but not many. It's not really that much of a difference for me recently to move from 16 hours of fasting to 20 to 21 hours a day just to see if I felt any better, and I do. You know, I still don't get particularly hungry because the fats have got such a high energy fuel. But I think really that's a good segue into to Tony to talking about the benefits of low carb, high fat, and in particular, you've done some work with people with type 1 diabetes and stuff, haven't you, Tony?
Yeah. Indeed, I have, and it's very rewarding work as well. Alex's story is very, very interesting and fairly typical, I think. I mean, there's a lot in what he said there. There's almost a book in what he said there. I could talk about various aspects of that story. But when I work with type 1 diabetics, the ones I've dealt with have had completely failed pancreatic function, basically. So their beta cells have basically all packed up. The theory is there's some sort of autoimmune response which destroys their ability to produce insulin. And so they are then beholden to have some sort of external help, because when the body wants to use glucose from the blood, it needs insulin to unlock the cells so that the glucose can go into the cell, basically. So if you haven't got any insulin at all, that mechanism of getting the blood sugar down is severely inhibited. So I guess it depends on how much damage has been done to those beta cells, as to how you can cope with or without external help, and how your diet will affect your ability to cope with your blood glucose issues. And I think the good thing about diet is that by getting the correct diet, you can take away some of the variables. And with very many things in science, if you can remove variables from the picture, you can then control the situation a lot more easily. And if you think every time you eat a carbohydrate, that's effectively sugar in your blood. So you're then challenging your body to say, you've got to deal with this sugar now that you've just put in your mouth. Whereas if you remove that input through your mouth, you then reduce the body to a very simplistic self-controlling mechanism. And if that's not coping, then you know how to supplement that mechanism to allow it to cope. Mm-hmm. And what the people I've dealt with, they've come to me and they have two types of help. They have a basal and a bolus dose of, let's call it, synthetic insulin. Now, the basal dose is supposed to be a longer-acting, slow-burning, if you like, that seeps into the system over a period of time and then helps the body deal with the glucose situation over an extended period of time. Some people take one dose of this basal, slow-burning stuff, and some people split it. The thing that you can do to help the situation is reduce the bolus doses. And these are the ones that people, where they have to inject immediately after a meal because they've consumed carbohydrates and that's raised their blood sugar. Mm. If you continually eat carbohydrates, you're continually in a position where you have to inject this synthetic help to get rid of the blood sugar that you've caused by eating what you've eaten. And so the way I help people is to stabilize that bolus aspect of it so that they're not having to inject their bodies after every meal and let the basal insulin that's present in their system deal with the relatively small spikes in the glucose in their blood. Yeah. It sounds to me like if you're not taking any external medication, it sounds to me like you've got some function in your pancreas that is allowing your body to keep on dealing with the sugar issue. Is that yeah, true?
Yeah, I would agree. I would definitely agree. I mean, I was told that my pancreas wasn't working, and they said this in the hospital: my pancreas wasn't working, we need to give you insulin. And so, but But the reason why I disagree with that is because I see my blood sugars go up and down. Okay. Now, I do see my blood sugars move up in an extreme way, you know, at some point, as I say, if I was ill or if even before ill, I would know that I was going to be feel a bit rough, or I might be overworked, or the body's overworked, et cetera, et cetera. It might be something emotional. I might have had an argument. I might have, you know, something's not gone my way. Just, you know, just normal things in life. And those will impact blood sugars as well. But the main thing is as I've seen this range go up, it is 100% what goes into your system. And as I say, I've seen what I've put into my system, that my pancreas is dealing with it in some way. How you get the pancreas to be fully functional again. And I was interested when Adrian mentioned about, you know, that everything can be, you know, the body's only sort of like 7 months old every time it, you know, plus the fact that from my own research, sort of like with regards to blood, it replenishes itself every 90 days. So if that happens and there's so many aspects throughout the body that are changing or repairing themselves, then ultimately you could put a lot of things right and minimize where your weakness is. Does that make sense?
Definitely. Yeah. I think I don't think that the medical profession fully understand what causes that autoimmune destruction of the beta cells of the pancreas. I don't think they fully understood science. All they can tell us, I think, is that that is happening for some reason. And I think there's a lot to be said for there's a possibility that if you make your body healthy, then it will try its best to repair those beta cells or regenerate beta cells or stop that autoimmune response. So the better health generally that you're in, I think the better chance you have of restoring pancreatic function. That would be my intuitive understanding what would happen. But the more people go down the wrong pathway, the more likely they are to exaggerate the problem that they've got and end up with a pancreas that doesn't work in any way, shape or form.
Well, see, my you know, philosophy around that is that from what I was told with regards to food, I can still eat rice, I can still have milk, I can still have potatoes. You know, I can only have this much amount of rice on a plate. Do you know what I mean? And I said, I don't want that much rice. I'm not going to eat that rice. I'm not going to, you know, I'm going to go for alternatives. So I don't think that people that are, you know, in my experience and what I've seen is that people that are having to take insulin do nothing with their diet. They carry on eating because the hospital will turn around and say, yeah, just carry on eating like a normal eat and drink like you have been and take the insulin levels, and that's going to reduce your blood sugar. But then if you're looking, people will turn around and say that insulin going into the body could have a longer term problem later on down the line. And then if you look at diabetes, they associate it with amputation. They're associated with loss of sight. You know, there's so, again, if you go and Google it and you don't, you're going to go and find this information. It's there in front of you. It leads on to this. It leads on to heart failure. It leads on to all sorts. Well, in my opinion, it doesn't have to be that. You can slow that process down and potentially, again, my belief, stop that process.
Yeah.
But you have to take control of what you're eating. And you're going to have to go and find this information out through, you know, alternative, holistic professionals, because they're the ones that know the information. That's That's why I was interested in speaking to you, Tony, because I was mesmerized by what you did. You know, it was, and I could see the level of information that you've given to yourself. Was amazing. It was amazing. It was brilliant. You know, and you've got that ability, and you've got that knowledge to be able to say, right, I'm going to look at it like this. And I think one of the, I mentioned to Adrian, one of the important parts was the mathematics. And you mentioned Tesla and the numbers around the frequencies. It all means something. And I think that collectively we put all these things together and we can actually move forward. And you could start to repair yourself. You know, it will be different for everyone. You can't just say it's a bulk standard blanket and that's it. But if you make the moves in the right direction, you can start getting benefits in certain ways, you know?
The system at the moment deals with type 2 diabetics in what I consider to be an irresponsible way, in that the official advice that they will be given is, as Alex said, is to carry on eating carbohydrates, particularly the complex carbohydrates. And they're actually told to make that the centerpiece of every main meal that they have. And all this is doing is exacerbating the problem they have, because they're just shoveling this unnecessary carbohydrate into their bodies, which demands insulin or adds to their insulin resistance problem. And that just promotes the necessity for more allopathic intervention, more drugs. And it's just a no-brainer for type 2 diabetics. They have functioning pancreases. They can produce insulin. All they need to do is reduce the insulin resistance. And to do that, LCHF, you know, a low-carb, high-fat diet, is definitely the way forward. It's a no-brainer. And yet the system has brainwashed itself into believing that they should carry on as normal and just eat the same carbohydrates that caused the problem in the first place. Now, the problem becomes more severe for people that cannot produce their own insulin. So people who are completely shot in terms of their pancreas beta cells. And I think at the moment, Alex is probably somewhere between the two, because he seems to be able to cope without having to inject insulin. But obviously the body's struggling to deal with the glucose load. But in either case, it makes sense to reduce the carbohydrate intake, because carbohydrate is not required by the body in any way. The body can cope quite happily with just fats and proteins. Mm-hmm. The only reason to consume carbohydrate is to consume vitamins and minerals and fiber that your body might require if they haven't got it from other sources. And so for a type 1 diabetic, I want to reduce their glycemic load on their body by reducing their carbohydrate intake. That will then allow their body, if they are producing some insulin, that amount of insulin that's produced will have less stress on it to deal with the sort of fluctuations in the glucose in your blood. So if you strip your carbohydrate intake right back, just rely on fats and proteins, which require very little insulin to deal with. Fats, almost no insulin is required, and proteins, very little, then you will stabilize your blood glucose, Alex. I can guarantee you will, if your body is producing some insulin. Now, where you can run into problems is if you start exercising as a type 1 diabetic, because then the demands of the body in terms of its energy starts to change the dynamic of the management of energy within the body, because the body can only process fat as a source of fuel at a certain rate. So if you start really demanding a lot of energy by doing some really intense cardiovascular work, you can deplete the glucose that is available. There's some insulin pushing that glucose into your cells, but it gets used up very quickly if you're not consuming carbohydrates. And so for athletes who are type 1 diabetics, life becomes quite challenging, but it's not insurmountable. There are lots of really good athletes. I know personally a few of them, and they cope admirably. They do marathons, they do all anything anybody else would do as an athlete. But understanding how the body is dealing with this energy management issue. And so what I would advise most people who are type 1 diabetics is to strip everything back so that you know what state your body is in and what it can cope with and what it can't cope with. Because then you'll get some feel for if you need any external help. And what I don't accept for type 1 diabetics is that they have to live with this enhanced level of glycation, sugarness in their body. You're talking about millimoles per liter up in the teens. To me, that is not acceptable because it leads to glycation of the capillaries. And this is why we talk about people losing their sight through diabetes. It's because these small vessels are getting sugared up, basically, and it's causing that. And sugar, the body's got to get rid of it. It starts to shovel it wherever it can. And this is why limbs get amputated, because they just get full of sugar and just rot, basically. I don't accept that the type 1 should have to deal with levels of millimoles per litre, which are abnormal. They're dangerously abnormal over a chronic period of time. And the people I've worked with have managed to get their sort of resting glucose in the same bracket as mine. My normal glucose is now around about 4.5, probably between 4.2 and 4.5. And it's known that if you've got glucose in that range between sort of 4 and 5, that you won't get these problems of glycation in
that's
the
body. Right.
And the long-term health prospects are far, far better.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And so when you've stabilized everything and know what the level of the problem is, then you can say, well, okay, even though I'm eating no carbohydrates, my body's still giving me a general glucose level of 6 or 7 millimoles per litre, which is still too high. Then you might say, okay, why don't we try a little bit of basal insulin to help? Because then you know what the problem is, you know the level of the problem, and then you know how much help it needs if you get to that level, rather than just putting up with this excessive amount of glucose in your body, which may cause you long-term issues.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. Yeah, it does. It was strange. It's funny as well, because with regards to the insulin, they did give me a drip, and there was an insulin drip that they gave me, IV drip. And obviously that brought my blood sugar, because I said I didn't want insulin, but I agreed to this. And they said, we're going to get your insulin levels down. So that actually took me to sort of like 3.5. And then I sort of like had a bit of a high post.
Glucose levels, not insulin levels. Yeah.
Sorry, say that again, sorry?
I think you said insulin levels. You mean your glucose levels went down to 3.5?
Oh, yes. Glucose levels went down to 3.5 after they gave me this the IV drip with the insulin in it, however that is. So is that less evasive than having injections of insulin? That I don't know, but it was always a question that I thought, you know, is there, you know, something that we could get into our system that would actually help without it being injected? Is it the same, you know, or was it different? That was always one of the questions that I pondered over.
Well, hypoglycemia is very dangerous. Obviously, getting down to 3.5, you're getting into sort of dangerous areas when you drop below 3, particularly.
Yeah.
And so the balance always, particularly with type 1s, is you don't want to overload the amount of insulin that's flowing through the system. Because if you do that, then you will go hypo. And then then you have to eat something like with sugar in it to get that level back up.
Yeah.
So particularly with athletes, you want to avoid this hypo situation where you've got too much insulin in the system. So the sugar's all being blown out of the blood. And then drop, because you want it to be around about 5, ideally, most of the time.
Yeah.
To maintain it in that range is quite hard if you're doing activity, but it's a lot easier if you're just living normally and you haven't got that excessive flow. So they must have given you some insulin to get your level down from what it was to 3.5.
Yeah, that was it, through the drip, as I say. And I literally went from 32 in the space of a couple of hours being on this drip. I went to 3.5. And as I say, that's when I sort of like started to lose focus. I couldn't really concentrate. And I thought, what's going on? Then I started to sweat. And that you're like on the verge of passing out. And I said, I need something to eat. But the strange thing is that they gave me a sandwich.
Yeah.
Which would do the job, but then send the blood sugars back up.
Yeah.
And this is what I'm saying. There's a lack of understanding. They might have been better just giving me a date. And that one date, 10 minutes later, would have sort of like brought my blood sugars back up.
Yeah.
And I think that there's that time, there's an element of time where your body's got to adjust.
Yeah.
So just like when I'm sort of like saying my blood sugars have gone up bit by bit by bit and I've brought them down bit by bit by bit, it's not going to work straight away. You know, it's going to take a little bit of time. You know, you've got to work with your body as well, you know?
Yeah. Well, the way I deal with it, type 1 diabetics is I say, okay, I look at their meals, what they eat, and then I sort of advise them how to restructure those meals to reduce the glycemic load. And then I get them to monitor the effect on their glucose of eating specific types of meals or foods.
Yeah.
Because what I aim for with them is to have the basal, the sort of low release insulin, because these people are injecting this basal dose, I want that to be able to cope with all the fluctuations throughout the day. So they don't have to compensate for the meal with extra insulin. And so if you eat a meal that has a very limited impact on the blood glucose level, what you find is that the amount of insulin that's just naturally flowing from this slow release insulin will easily deal with the spike. It's not a spike. It just gradually goes up when you eat something, if you eat the right things. And then this basal stuff will deal with it and settle it back down to normal. So they don't have these massive spikes when they eat their meals. That has to be dealt with the extra injections, if you like. And it's finding the balance. And that all comes from data. So I get them to monitor, do their pricks, find out what foods have what impact. And then they can say, okay, well, if I eat a banana, I get this massive spike. So don't eat bananas then. And because eat something that hasn't got that glycemic load on the body.
Yeah.
Then you can stabilize their blood glucose throughout the day just using this basal. Now, if you've got some functionality in your pancreas, that will give you this background insulin that will be able to deal with these very minor demands on the glycemic load.
Yeah.
And that's what I try to get people to understand. And once they understand that and implement it, I find that they don't have to take these extra. So you won't get these massive fluctuations in your glucose because you're eating the correct food.
And so
if you base... I mean, it's not one sort of recipe suits all diabetics, I'm sure. Each diabetic has their own issues and their own way of dealing it. The body will deal it in their own way. And it's getting the data so that you know for your individual body what sort of throws it off and what keeps it in a nice, stable condition.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny because, for a good sort of like year and three quarters, you know, it's only been the last couple of months where I've had this fluctuation. Normally, with what I've eaten, I've kept it within that range. I never really went overly high unless I was, you know, I was ill. You know, not ill, but you know what I mean, like. You know, something was up, you know. I've been good. And it's only been these past couple of months where I've had this raise. But as I say, I've got it down. So I know that my body can do it. But look, most people wouldn't really want to just have the one meal a day in a small amount of time and then. And then, you know, they want to eat something then in, you know, in the morning, in the afternoon, in the evening, you know what I mean? So they're going to sit down, they want to eat dinner with their family or something like that. So instead of just having something like say 1 or 2 o'clock, and then that's the, you're putting everything into your system then, and then just leaving it until you come round to that again. My blood sugars will have gone down because I've done that, but like what you said, they will go up with what I eat. But you mentioned sort of like fats and proteins to eat. What sort of foods would you recommend?
Well, I think I always aim for very low carb type foods, but foods that are intrinsically full of nutrition. So things like if I have a breakfast type meal, I will have, say, 3 eggs, an avocado, and some grated cheese in the mix there somewhere with some olive oil, cook the eggs in butter. So it's predominantly fat. It's got a proportionate amount of protein, very little carbohydrate, and lots of nutritional value in terms of vitamins and minerals. Now, to me, that's a perfect meal because it supplies the body with vital stuff. It doesn't give it any of the stuff it doesn't need, and it doesn't increase your glycemic load. So you're not going to need a lot of insulin to deal with that meal.
No.
There's a lot of goodness in there that the body will have to deal with, but it's not requiring insulin to deal with it.
No, that's correct, yeah.
If you're insulin challenged, that's the perfect type of meal to eat.
Yeah.
And you don't have to not eat. I mean, fasting is fantastic. It's got so many benefits, but there's still this social aspect of life, which is important because it reduces our stress. All this being surrounded by love and interacting with people we like being with is an important aspect of life. So I wouldn't use fasting at the expense of something that's important to a family environment. Yeah. But it's just eating the right things when you do eat. So even if your family are stuffing themselves with rice and pasta and bread, etc., you just have to have the discipline, I guess, to say, okay, well, I'm not going to eat that part of this meal. I'm still going to take part in the meal, but I'm just not going to have a bit that's going to challenge my insulin response, and that will keep my insulin demand low, and it will keep my blood sugar in a reasonable range to keep me healthy. One or the other, and it depends, of course, if you're following a certain type of diet, whether you're vegan or vegetarian or carnivore or somewhere between, as to how you actually manage what you can eat. I find that, again, if you take something like a steak, it's very nutritionally dense. But obviously, if you're vegetarian or vegan, that's not going to be an option for you. So you have to look at something else that will give you those sorts of...
That's where I'm at, because I went straight to sort of like the vegan, vegetarian, predominantly vegan.
Yeah.
And that's what I looked at first of all. And realistically, that's what drove down the blood sugars with other herbs and supplements as well on top. But I would, look to add them into my body. So, I would be eating, spinach, onions, peppers, avocados, those type of things, putting them in salads. Lettuce, maybe a little bit of kale.
But cutting out meat, you're not cutting out the carb out. I mean, meat is predominantly fat and protein. So what you've got to, I think, understand about the vegan vegetarian diet is that all fruits and vegetables are basically carbohydrates. So they've got obviously vitamins, minerals, etc., and they've got fiber in various quantities, but they are all carbohydrates. So by eating fruit and vegetables, you're always introducing carbohydrates into your body.
And
what I always try and advise people on those types of diets is to consider the actual vegetable or the actual fruit that they predominantly eat to reduce glycemic load again. So if you eat a banana, for example, that's like eating 6 teaspoons of sugar, just like that.
Yeah.
So banana's not a good thing to be eating as a sort of a staple fruit, if you like. Whereas if you look at the glycemic load of something like a blueberry or a blackberry or a raspberry, strawberry, sort of berries, the glycemic load is much lower. And so it's a matter of looking, doing the research and saying, okay, let's get a table of glycemic indices for the various fruits and the various vegetables, and then gravitate towards the ones that put the least glycemic load on your body. So you want to avoid the bananas, the tropical fruits, and other pineapples, the mangoes, the raisins and sultanas, the grapes. They're all very high glycemic load, whereas the sort of blue dark berries are very low glycemic load. And you can do the same for vegetables. So the leafy green vegetables that grow above the ground, the kale, the spinach, like you said, the broccoli, the sprouts.
That's it.
They're much lower in glycemic load than, say, carrots or parsnips or sweet. And just by making that informed choice about where you gravitate towards the predominant vegetables and fruit you eat, that will really help anybody with a diabetic issue to just stabilize blood sugars. And then it's just the knowledge, so that you know a banana is a treat or something to have when you're exercising versus sat watching the TV at night with the family. Don't have a banana with a fruit snack. Have a bowl of blueberries or something.
No, I agree. Yeah, 100%. Yeah, I mean, the only difference is the meat perspective and the dairy. You know, I would use like cheese alternatives. The vegan cheese made from coconut. I mean, some of them aren't that great.
I mean, cheese is a fantastic food, really, because it's got a nice balance of fat and protein, almost no carbohydrate, if any, and then it's got things like calcium and stuff. So it's a good thing to snack on or use as one of your staple food groups, I think, anyway. I always go for lots of full-fat creams and stuff because I need to get the fat into my body on a low-carb stuff. You still need the calorific value, but it needs to come in the form of fat or protein, and so dairy is quite an important way that I get my fat into my diet. So I use a lot of olive oil, a lot of butter, a lot of lard, so all of these good sources of fat that, of course, many people are put off because of the cholesterol heart hypothesis nonsense. They're taught from a very young age to demonize cholesterol and saturated fat. And that puts them off these natural, healthy ways of getting the calories that we need into our bodies in a good way. Society's been seduced into thinking that carbohydrates, processed carbohydrates, should be the staple main source of our calorific intake. And that's why all the kids are eating the pastas and the rices and the breads and stuff as a staple part of their diet, instead of moving away from that towards these lovely fats that make our body healthy.
Yeah, definitely. No, I totally agree.
You got any comment? Because I know Adrian. I think Adrian's more vegan, vegetarian sort of way. And I always say that I don't think you can say that there's one diet that is the diet that people should have. I think people should listen to their bodies and listen to their own their intuition about what's making them healthy and go down that route. And as long as they're getting the basic nutritional requirements of a diet.
It
doesn't matter if it's carnivore or vegan or whatever. You just need to get your body healthy through intaking the right things at the right time in the right quantities and not eating in the at the right times. And, you know.
Yeah, I mean, in my situation, I was vegan for a very long time. And then when I found more about raw dairy, and then I found a dairy nearby that I could get raw milk and particularly raw cream. And we can get raw cheese. And there's a guy up the road who's got a couple of hundred chickens that run around the woods behind his house. So they're eating the natural stuff. They're not eating crap.
Yeah.
I've introduced those back into my diet. And in fact, now I pretty much have half a tub of raw cream every day. And I found that reintroducing the saturated fats like that are good, but I wouldn't have pasteurized anything. It has to be all unpasteurized.
Yeah. It's availability, isn't it, of this sort of stuff that's been taken away from people's choice, really, if not by availability, by price. So if you take the organic stuff, I try and eat everything I consume is organic if I can make it that way, but the cost for the average person is so hard to deal with on their budgets, yeah, that it excludes the vast majority of the population.
But what's really strange, I found that the eggs I get, I pay £1 for half a dozen. For the raw milk, I pay £2 for 4 litres. For the raw cream, I think it's £1.75 for a tub about that big. So it's actually cheaper than buying in the supermarkets anyway, because I'm local to it.
Yeah, I think probably a lot of that is that they produce a fair bit of it, but the most consumers will be put off it by the system. They'll say, oh, it's too dangerous to eat non-pasteurised stuff.
Well, he actually, just give me one sec. I'll read you the label. I'll be back in a second. This is hysterical.
No, it's interesting because you're totally bang on with what you say. And there's people out there that, from a budget perspective, they're going to have to go to, going to go to the supermarket and buy, things that are cheap enough for the family, like chips and, breaded chicken and, all these things that you could just bang in the oven and that's it. And they don't come with the best nutrition value,
You know what's funny with this? There's always a label on this, and this particular one hasn't got a label on it, but it basically says you shouldn't drink it because it's dangerous. and the guy, he's been selling this for 60 odd years, and he's constantly being attacked by the ministry. He has to pay for loads of tests every year. His herd has never been inoculated. They don't spray any chemicals on the land. It's all natural fertilizer from the cattle. But again, most of what he sells goes to be put into normal pasteurization. But if you go to his place at the garage, you can buy in a little fridge at the front everything you want.
Yeah,
and there are resources. There's plenty of places around the UK. There's a raw milk website you can go on. But I just need to go back, put this back in the fridge again. So I'll see you in a sec.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I hope you're getting something of value out of this, Alex. It's brilliant to talk to you.
I'm really interested to get your views on different things. And there are been certain things that I've taken out of my diet, which potentially, I could have a look at, and see if I can incorporate them again. Because as you say, they're not going to impact my blood sugars, but obviously from a taste perspective, you can, bring them back in, which is good. I mean, I look at low glycemic index fruits, and I do like a banana, But again, it would be like, it might be part of a juice in that respect. It might just be half a banana. If my blood sugars were to go low, I bet it's only really had a couple of occasions where they've been low. I've always had a couple of dates to hand, which would sort of like regulate it quite quickly, give you a natural sugar. But yeah. I've always been under the impression that from a fruit perspective, there's a difference between sugar and fructose. Going in, so it's less evasive. It goes straight into the cell. It doesn't need so much effort for the body to sort of like digest it, process it. So, but again, I would be looking at raspberries, blueberries, blackberries, strawberries, those type of things.
Well, what you want to look at is the sugars is a generic term for these substances. I mean, in milk, the sugar is lactose, for example. The white stuff that people put in their tea is sucrose, and that's made up of glucose and fructose combined, if you like. And the body deals with various sugars in different ways. Most of them are dealt in the same way as glucose. Glucose is the sort of currency of the blood sugar, if you like. Fructose is actually a toxin, if you think about it, because it can't go straight into the system and be used as fuel. It has to go to the liver to be processed. It's very much like alcohol. It has to go to the liver to be processed. So in that way, fructose is almost toxic. And most of the sugar composition of fruit is fructose. And so when you eat this fruit, that all of the sugar doesn't go. So the glucose component will go into the blood directly almost, but the fructose component will go via the liver to be rejigged, if you like. And this is why alcoholics get fatty liver disease, because the alcohol has to go to the liver to be processed. And it's not required for energy and stuff. It's not converted for energy. It's stored as fat. And so this is why you see alcoholics with fatty liver disease. You can actually get fatty liver disease from eating too much fructose, really, because the body's got to do something with this stuff, and if it's not required for energy, it might store it as fat in the liver or elsewhere in the body.
I agree. I've actually had someone that that I know that had got a fatty liver, and they don't really drink at all. So it would have been caused by something else. But the hospital was saying, you know, do you drink a lot? No. And then they don't believe you. You know what I mean?
Fatty liver disease is quite a common thing these days. And it's because people are consuming carbohydrates, basically, but fructose in particular. And so, again, you can look at the fructose content of the fruit that you're consuming versus the glucose content. As you said, use natural products. If you're going hypo in any way, just use the natural things like banana or a date or honey, something like that. I use a lot of honey if I want a quick burst of energy. So when I'm on the bike and I'm approaching a hill, I'll take Manuka honey or a date to just give my body a little bit of a readily available energy in the form of glucose or fructose.
No, that's brilliant, yeah.
That was really interesting. Thank you. Really interesting. I've learned a lot.
That's the main thing.
It's a fascinating. I find it fascinating helping diabetics, because I think they've been led down the wrong path, and I don't know if it's possible to cure a shot of pancreas. I don't know if, Alex, you will be able to get away with not having some help at some point from an external source of insulin.
Yeah,
these are unknown things as far as I'm concerned. But I think there's still that the system doesn't do diabetics any favor by frightening them or giving them incorrect information about the best way to deal with their diets. One of my sort of crusades is to try and change the basic information that are given, particularly to type 2 diabetics, about what they should eat as staple foods, because they can turn their diabetes around, because they're
straight around
in a matter of months.
Yeah. And
it's known science. It's known. We've got data that shows that this can be done. And yet the system prevents people like me driving that way of dealing with it. It just prevents me getting any leverage, because they know that then they lose the pharmaceutical input that they need at the moment.
See, the funny thing is sort of like with type 2, you know, you'd be put on metformin straight away. But as you said, you can change your type 2 condition very quickly and allow the body to recover from the situation. But you've got to know about that. You've got to be able to do that. And the information is not there. You know what I mean? You're not going to get this from, you know, because from my experience, you know, what the nutritionist said at the hospital, it wasn't happening for me. You know, no, I won't be having that. So this is the general consensus, is that information, when it comes out, is not really helping. And when you sort of like say to people sort of like type 2, you can change that. You can change that around, and you don't have to be type 2 diabetic. You can actually. I'll give an example. My dad, type 2 diabetic, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, psoriasis. He went to the doctors. They turned around and said, we're going to put he'd never been to the doctors in at least 60 years. I've never, ever known my dad to go to the doctors. You know what I mean? He's grafted all of his life. And he ended up going to the doctors. The doctors turned around and said, we're going to put you on statins. And literally said, if you don't have the statins, you'll die. That was it. So he ended up taking the statins. And you could see he'd obviously got worse and worse, and to the point where his legs gave way at some point. My mum showed him an article in the paper. It said about this guy that taken statins ended up being in the chair, you know what I mean, in the armchair, couldn't get out. He stopped taking the statins and got himself back to health by powering his way through weights, and ended up going down the gym 5 days a week. He got his health back like that, or got his movement back like that. My mum showed him that. He ended up not, he sort of said, I don't think they're doing you any favours. He decided not to take the statins anymore. I just said to him, look, Dad, I can't sort of say to my dad, take these supplements and these spices and this does this and this does this, because he's too old school. And I said to him, look, let's simplify it. Eat this in the morning, eat this in the afternoon, eat this in the evening, everything will go. He said, okay, then I'll do it. He did it for about 4 months. He went back to the hospital, he went back to the doctors, he did a blood test. So it was approximately sort of like 4.5 months later. He goes in, he sees the doctor. She turns around and says, thanks for coming in. The good news is you've lost 2.5 stone. We've done your blood tests. You're no longer diabetic, type 2. We've got your blood pressure results. Your blood pressure's gone back to normal and your cholesterol level's gone back to normal. So she said, I can see that your psoriasis has gone down and I can't tell you how well you look. So she said, so how are you getting on with the statins? He said, well, funny you should mention it. I've not taken them. And she said, oh, well, you can't just not take the statins. He said, well, I've just started taking them, so I just stopped taking them. So they said, what did you do? My boy told me what to eat. She said, well, I'll maybe come back in about 6 months and let me see how you're getting on.
Yeah, it's amazing. Well, it's very similar to my story in many ways, because the statins were the centerpiece of my ill health. And I had a very similar journey to your father, I think. I think that's one of the main problems we've got in the medical world at the moment is the statin issue. There's so many people been putting those things that are just damaging their bodies, not helping them in any way at all. So we need to dispel the cholesterol heart hypothesis once and for all and move on from that, I think.
Yeah. Definitely.
We could wrap it up now if you guys want. That was absolutely amazing. Thank you.
Yeah. I'm on. Whatever you want to do, Adrian, don't mind.
Okay. Well, we'll call it a final on this one, but let's do another one shortly because that was interesting and I think we have much more to talk about.
Yeah, brilliant.
Yeah, definitely. I've got your email as well, Tony. Which Adrian gave me. I might contact you about some different foods and stuff like that to get your opinion on and see what you think.
Yeah, I'd love to. Love to help out with that.
Brilliant. Yeah.
Right. You guys are brilliant. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Take care, guys.
Take care. See you later. Ta-da. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.